Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 74, section 6, which is old single column, page 834. Okay. Recall that, after the upheaval we read about last time, they got into giving us some of the details of how things went for the short time that they were going smoothly, relatively smoothly, there in the first garden. And we're going to get into more and more specifics along those lines. We'll start out, we'll probably spend a fair amount of time just shortly after we start out. They're going to give us, though, besides the, the stuff that's sort of related to a day in the life and the garden sort of things, how things were basically set up and educationally and whatnot, they're going to give us a little bit more on the nature of material sons and daughters. Obviously, specifically, material sons and daughters functioning as Adams and Eves. In particular, some very interesting stuff about just how ordered their procreation is. So that's going to be very interesting to unpack that. We'll spend a fair amount of time so that everyone kind of can appreciate why they give us a whole bunch of details there so that you can put it all together. I think that's probably about all we need to say up front. Let's just jump in so we have plenty of time to look at all these details.
Section 6, Home Life of Adam and Eve. The Adamic family grounds embraced a little over 5 square miles. Immediately surrounding this home site, provision had been made for the care of more than 300,000 of the pure line offspring. But only the first unit of the projected buildings was ever constructed. Before the size of the Adamic family outgrew these early provisions, the whole Edenic plan had been disrupted and the garden vacated.
Okay. So just a couple little details they're giving us up front there to sort of set the stage again. And, you can see they don't have a vast estate. But, it's reasonable size. If it's square, it's not that much on a side, to be 5 square miles. It's definitely a healthy home site. And notice they gave us another little detail here about provision had been made for the care of more than 300,000 of the pure line offspring. You may recall back towards the end of the preceding paper, they said the following: the Melchizedek's counseled Adam not to initiate the program of racial uplift and blending until his own family had numbered 500,000. So you have that difference there. They're supposed to build up pure line to 500,000 before they start really engaging in procreation with the evolutionary peoples. But you have provision here for only 300,000.
Yeah, but they could have built more later, right? They just put 300,000 and start out.
They had just a handful built.
Yeah, well.
But see, the provision, there is, that region is only meant to be built out to handle 300,000 is what they're getting at there. It's the point is that there's yet another, if you just put those two together, of how much the garden was not a long-term home. I mean, even before they start engaging the evolutionary peoples, biologically, they're going to have a lot of people outside in these satellite headquarters. And you can, if you think about some of the things they say in the book, you can probably even think, oh yeah, the Melchizedek plan knows about, you know, North and South America, for instance. You know, at what point, you know, might there supposed to have been an effort to, you know, to get a significant number of people built up, you know, for the Western Hemisphere?
These are all pure line,
though. Right, it's all pure line, yeah. I mean, that's just one possible speculation you could throw in. About whether or not, like they say, that there was supposed to be this, you know, big contingent that was going to build up to engage Red Man. You know, was something like that maybe, you know, going to be in even the earlier stages? You know, this seems to suggest something along that line of, you know, something like 200,000 are going to be outside before it starts going. So, you know, I mean, it's just the reason I'm stressing that is, you know, back there, that spot I read about the 500,000, the next thing it says is, it was never intended that the garden should be the permanent home of the Adamites. Remember when, you know, just noticing you put those two together, it just emphasizes that second sentence there, back there, right? That it was supposed to just be a short-term core phenomenon, and you know, and even in the near time horizon, they were going to be moving out.
That's a significant difference in numbers, but actually, we're only probably talking a generation or two. I mean, things would be happening,
right? Yeah.
Fast,
especially when you get out on the road.
Speaking, yeah. At this point in time.
Sure. Yeah, and did you have something too?
Yeah, I do. You know, when they talk about the whole normal planets, you know, they have the prince's headquarters wherever they are, and
right.
Then they have the Adam, you know, the garden,
right. Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they get garden satellites because they talk mm-hmm. about that around, and then they also talk about the whole tradition aspect of imagine what it'd be like if you had something that was 35,000 or 500,000.
Right.
So there must have, you would think that normally, you know, the original place or something like that might exist, even though there would be satellites all over. What you're saying is that in this particular case,
right.
Maybe because of the place that Fan and Amidon chose or their team chose, they knew that was not going to probably exist that long, or
yeah. Remember, that's what they said back there in that previous paper when we talked about that. That was the whole point, that
just a physical space.
You know, the revelators, everyone, you know, understands that no one thought that was going to be a long term, and it's not some sort of you know, change of plan that first garden sank and everything. It was all just kind of set up that way. Right, I mean, and everyone knew that. Everyone was planning for that. It was supposed to just be a short term, just a place where they could be quasi-isolated and get themselves up to numbers and integrity before they really exposed themselves to the, you know, the difficulty of this world.
So had it existed, I mean, mm-hmm. had they not defaulted or whatever,
yeah.
Would there be a, theoretically, normally, I got the picture from reading this, that there normally on a planet would be a place where they're, you know, Adam and Eve held, you know, lived, which would be the center. There may be other gardens around the world.
Well, and see, I tell you that the way it was supposed to work here, I mean, obviously there would have been a place, you know, that would be their home base somewhere, okay? But that the whole point was for them to not be at that home base for long stretches of time. They were supposed to be constantly moving around to the satellite headquarters. That was supposed to be the way it was supposed to work. So, you know, they were going to be quite roving heads of the world, in contrast to the way it normally is. Like you're saying, it's obvious that normally there's this very definitive place where they, you know, they are there at that central location most of the time or something.
Then why do they use yeah. that other comparison about when they talk about tradition? Mm-hmm. You know, about if you there was a place that had been center of the garden for 35,000, and then the other one for, you know what I'm saying?
So yeah, well, you know,
like there would
right. But go back and remember. Let's see, where was that? Remember where it says that? The peninsula had been overrun by these lower grade Noddites for almost 4,000 years after Adam left the garden. When? Right, in connection with the violent activity. Right, see, it wasn't that long.
No.
Right, see, so, you know, they would have set up a new home base
somewhere,
and it would have been around for a very, very long time.
That's what I was driving at.
Right. So, I mean, and again, see, you know, 4,000 years when we're talking about 40, right? Right.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it's just, you know, the reason I'm focused on this, it's just yet another little kind of footnote reminder that our long-time fixation on going back to the garden, you know, is we're not synchronized with this world when we think like that. You know, that's not the kind of world that you were meant to be raised in. Even if everything had gone as according to plan, we're supposed to be a people that have kind of, that leave their nativity sphere with a kind of a different sense of things than a lot of mortals, right? And we're working against the nature of things when we think in terms of going back to the garden.
You really think so?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just that's just
maybe
a point
Jesus
that they're trying to stress.
To be a farmer, remember you do your
love. Yeah, well, that's fine. But that idyllic garden place, see, right?
I mean, utopia. Where
yeah, the know. Utopia on Earth place, yeah. Right, is not supposed to be.
is the pattern instead of the utopian garden place? Mm-hmm. Is the pattern maybe supposed to be more like uplifted places?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we get into speculation about how exactly these centers, if there had been, you know, how paradisiacal they would have been, you know, anyway. I don't know. You're just left to speculate about just, you know, having this being an Agendanter world like it is. You know, maybe that's not as different from what it was supposed to be as we initially think. Maybe we were supposed to be a people that that believed, yet we could not see. Right? there's
must be, because that's what happened.
Right, and that's what happened. I see in spades, of course. Right. Because of the rebellion and the fall, but you just get the sense when you think about some of these little details that maybe we were supposed to be all that much more differentiated from Havona than many worlds are.
To show that it still works.
Right, to just, you know, that maybe we were supposed to be one of those worlds that starts sort of as removed from the quality of Havona as you can get. Right, and yet you still make it to the aisle, right?
That's cool.
So it can kind of help you to find a little bit more peace about the rebellion and the default, and not make that such a big, you know, showstopper in your mind, right?
Well, it might be a little too soon to talk about this, but I've wondered sometimes about the number of Adamites there were. And of course, after most of them were taken off, it reduced the numbers again. In the second garden, you know, things didn't go that hunky-dory.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the Adamites maintained some integrity for a long time.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. You know,
so
they talk about that.
Actually did build up significantly.
Yeah, and they talk about that.
What happened after that, though, things didn't happen in an organized,
right,
planned out way. They
right.
just happened in an evolutionary way.
Yeah.
But I think it's there's still been a significant number people that have Adamic. If things had just gone well, it still would have been the Adamic. It's not like we had been a bunch of Adamites with a little salt and pepper Sangic mixed in. No, right. It'd be the other way around, just like it is.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, be a preponderance of Sangic uplifted by the Adamites.
Right, that's the way it always is.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
All right. So let's get to this next paragraph here now. This is the meaty paragraph that I was alluding to here. So just read through it, and then we'll slowly step through all the details.
Adam's son was the firstborn of the violet race of Urantia, being followed by his sister, and Eve's son, the second son of Adam and Eve. Eve was the mother of five children before the Melchizedeks left, three sons and two daughters. The next two were twins. She bore 63 children, 32 daughters, and 31 sons before the default. When Adam and Eve left the garden, their family consisted of four generations, numbering 1,647 pure line descendants. They had 42 children after leaving the garden, besides the two offspring of joint parentage with the mortal stock of earth. And this does not include the Adamic parentage to the Noddite and evolutionary races.
Let me just get the final little comments out of the way first. We'll eventually get to what they're referring to in that final sentence. That's about... you may recall they impregnated a bunch of evolutionary females with Adam, and increased the amount of uplift that way. We'll eventually get to that, and of course there's Cain and Laodicea that they're referring to, the two there. And we'll get to their story in a little bit. But the main thing is all these details about their procreation. And, at first blush, you think, well, they're just trying to kind of lay it all out. But, the more you think about it, but there's a lot of details. I mean, they're trying to give you enough, they're trying to pin down enough elements so that you can reflect on this and figure this all out. How this works with the procreation with material sons and daughters. The key is that you have, in terms of Mendel, right? The use, when Mendel coined that dominant recessive, terminology, right? You have that basic phenomenon where you have sets of four. We've seen, that comes up, time and time again in the book, with even very, very high beings, you may recall, that you have this this dominant recessive, hence sets of four in terms of producing beings, where you have a dominant, two dominant recessives, and then one recessive. Okay, so the first thing, though, we want to figure out is... that dominant recessive terminology that has lots of relativity. In this particular instance, what do we mean when we use those labels? Okay, so remember, take this all the way back. In every local system, you start with an initial, original pair, material sons and daughters, one material son, one material daughter, that starts out all of the material sons and daughters in each local system. That initial pair is attuned to the life in that local system, what the material life is going to be in that local system. And that original pair are created by just the Creator Son, by himself. It's not a combination of the Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit. Just the Creator Son gives rise to that initial pair. Okay, so, remember the parentage of a Creator Son. You have the Universal Father on the one hand, the Eternal Mother Son on the other hand. All right, so there is both Father and Mother Nature in a Creator Son, but they're called a Creator Son, not a Creator Daughter. All right, so obviously, just by the name, they're telling you that the Father is dominant and the mother in the Creator Son is recessive.
Though they do want to say that ours is more motherlike.
Right, but that's a different thing. Okay. We're just talking the, okay. The basic nature. Okay. Every Creator Son, regardless of that, how they function, in a personality mode or what, every Creator Son is a Creator Son. None of them are Creator Daughters. They're all, right, the Father deity is dominant over the Mother deity in that creative fact. It's both there. Like we point out, you can see that because the Creator Son can make both material son and material daughter. And if there wasn't that mother lineage in him, he couldn't make material daughters by himself. And you reflect on that, you appreciate how you should use the dominant recessive terms when you're thinking about material sons and daughters as Adams and Eves, or even before that, procreating. Okay, that dominant is going to refer to when you have a male-like aspect with the child, and recessive is going to refer to when you have a female-like aspect.
Unfortunately.
Not because we're speaking in some paternalistic society mode. No, it has to do with their Creator Sons, right? So that the Father is dominant there. Father is not dominant in a created Mother Spirit. That's a whole different story. Right? Okay, so you're going to have these sets of four. So now remember what they told us. About at the beginning of this paper, about the children that they had. Let me just turn you back and remind you where that is if you want to know. That's in the 5th paragraph of section 1 in this paper, where they said that they had 50 sons and 50 daughters back on Gerizim, right, that they left behind when they came here as Adam and Eve. Okay, so if those children are being produced in sets of four, right, then you have 25 sets of four that gave you those 100 children, those 50 sons and 50 daughters. Right? This is the way the set of four works is you've got a son, and then you've got a pair, one's a son and one's a daughter, and then you have a daughter, right? So that you have two sons and two daughters in the set of four. Okay. They're in the same mode when they come here, as they're saying here. So firstborn is Adamson. Okay, so that's the dominant. Now, how a little bit more precisely do we think about that? Remember that what you really are, despite it appears that you're a body, but that's not really you, right? You, that conscious fact, right, is a mindal self, not a, your self is not made out of molecules. Your self is made out of mind energy. You have a mindal self, okay? And in basic foundational terms, when a child is procreated, that mindal self is under two influences. One, that mindal self of that child, okay, that is attuned to its body, right? So the body is influencing the mindal self of that child. And until age 16, you are literally still within the domain of mind energy of your biologic parents. Right? So the mind of your biologic parents is also influencing the mindful self of that child.
Even if they passed on?
The issues of all that has to, you know, you have to come into how the creative mother spirit steps in and substitutes and whatnot. Just keep it simple first with the basics, you know, before we go off on all the what ifs. Okay, but yeah, there's lots and lots of what ifs that you can think about. But you know, remember all that's, you know, I'm putting together all kinds of things in various spots in the book that they tell us, right, about all this. Okay, now we've just gotten a detail that we've never had before about this influence of the parents' minds on the child's mind. We've just been given a little hint about this, that you know, a child has two parents. It's like, well, how does that work? Well, apparently, by what they've said here, pardon the pun, the apparent pun, there is a primary and a secondary influence mindily from the parents on the child. It's like, well, why do I say that? Because, okay, so the first child is a male, Adam's son, right? It's a male, and it's called Adam's son. The next son is called Eve's son. Okay? So let's put this together and understand. Okay, so the first one, is, you know, we would suspect it to be the dominant one. So, and it's Adam's son. So see, it's Adam is the primary mind influence on that child, and the child has a male body. Right? When we're talking male in this mode, that's the dominant. Right? See, so that's dominant. You know, both sort of top down, if you will, on the kid's mind, and bottom up on the kid's mind. It's a male influence, so it's the dominant one. That's Adamson. Think about, you know, Eve's son there. Okay, it's a male body, right? But it's called Eve's son, right? So Eve's mind is the primary influence on that child. Right. So that one, if we put it in mind-body order, right, that one is recessive dominant. Eve's son. See, that's why it's called Eve's son. Right? They have two male bodies. Right? You know, and you know, we know how male-female body works with Y chromosomes and X chromosomes. Okay, I mean, all that's happening, but you've got this mind influence, which is the primary mind influence, Adam or Eve. I mean, they're both influencing, but one is primary, obviously, because they're telling you one is Adam's son and one is Eve's son. Okay, and then you notice how it says, you know, so after Adam's son, being followed by his sister and Eve's son. Okay, his, Adam's son's sister, his sister. Ah, okay, female body, right, but Adam's the primary mind influence. Right? So that one's dominant recessive. See, and then they point out, you know, the next two were twins. Okay, it appears that the way this works, maybe most of the time, maybe all the time, for I mean, it may be literally that, you know, ordered, that you have a single child, then you have twins, and then a single child, and that's how you have the set of four. Let's just assume for simplicity's sake that that's the way it works. Single child, twins, single child, and that's your set of four. And in this case, right, it's a male, right, and of course there's a male and a female in the twins, and then the fourth one is a female. Right, Eve's son's sister. Right, see that one has Eve as the primary influence mindily on that child. And it's a female body, right? So it's recessive, the fourth one. See, and they point out here, Eve was the mother of five children before the Melchizedeks left, three sons and two daughters, right? Because you're going to have, so you've got, they're in sets of four, so you have two sons, two daughters with the first set of four, and then the fifth child is, here, a son, Okay. So, you know, in parallel to Adam's son, you have the next set of four, that leading dominant male child. Okay, before we go on to the other stuff here, just pause for a moment. They're giving you another little thing there. Five children before the Melchizedek. So why are they saying that? I mean, who cares how many kids they had before the Melchizedek? Well, think about it. Okay, they just told you it was almost 7 years, right? So what kind of a baby factory do we have here?
Prolific.
Okay, and I said that way very purposely, because think about this, okay? So you've got 9 months, right, from conception to birth. They'll tell you here in the next paragraph that she nurses for a year. Okay, so, you know, think about those five kids, you know, two of which, you know, are twins and born at the same time. Okay, if she doesn't conceive until she's done nursing, right, then you've got 4 9-month spans, that's 3 years, right, and you know, just to get the five into existence, you know, before you start nursing the five, you've got four. Three 1-year spans there. See, so you have 4 3-quarter year spans, and 3 1-year spans. That's 7 years, right? And so, right, she's nursing, you know, the next one. All right, I mean, there's no gap. I mean, she's getting pregnant, 9 months, giving birth, year of nursing, gets pregnant again, 9 months, nurses for a year, gets pregnant again. It's just boom, boom. There's no downtime.
Could even be getting pregnant while she's nursing.
Right. I mean, but you know, you can assume sort of like, I mean, even if she's doing it just like that, right? It fits. You know, you could imagine cramming it even tighter, but even when you spread it out, like, you know, see, it fits into the 7 years of the Melchizedek there.
Plus, if you go to the next one, they were here for, what do they say, 117 years.
Right, is there? You can, right, you can calculate. Yeah, you can start calculating that out.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, it appears that she basically has no downtime. She's either pregnant or nursing, nonstop, ad nauseum, literally. So, I mean, you know, I'm trying to stress that because, you know, these material daughters, this is a serious commitment they're making to become an Eve. I mean, all the, who knows how much time they were on Gerizim, you know, it's, you know, at least tens of thousands, it's probably millions of years, and they only have 100 kids. Okay, those are way spread out. But when they signed up to be an Adam and Eve, yeah. I mean, this is serious commitment. Yeah.
So now it makes the whole thing with the Eve default totally illogical. Because if she's pregnant as much as she possibly can be pregnant, why would she want to go get pregnant by somebody else?
Well,
I mean, it's not going to make it go any faster. She's just as pregnant as she can.
No. Remember, she's not trying to make it go faster. What she's trying to speed up is not how many kids she has, but how quickly they start blending into the evolutionary stock.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting until, like the Melchizedek said, until it's built up a long ways, she wants.
So she's the one who has to do it. I mean,
See, she took that on herself.
I was going to say that doesn't make sense. Well,
she was apart from Adam.
I mean, yeah.
Wearing mind a little bit.
Okay.
They don't do well when they're apart.
Besides the fact she was beguiled, but I mean, still.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, she wasn't, you know, I mean, she didn't meet the father until right, you know.
Somebody else.
Right. She, you know, remember, it's impatience. It's going to take a long time to build up 500,000 offspring, and we need to get going on this. She got convinced.
I understand
yeah.
that,
yeah.
but still doesn't make any sense because by getting pregnant by, what's his name?
Cana. Cana. Yeah.
She, you know, she could have just as easily gotten pregnant by Adam. I mean.
Yeah. Like I said, see, as I said, don't think, that's not the deal. It's not trying to make more pure line babies, right? You know, I mean, she's not making a pure line baby. She
understand that.
She wants to make a non-pure line baby.
But what is she? Unless she's trying to set an example for all her kids to do it, it would make no sense logically or mathematically. She's not going to get what she's looking for.
Are you trying to understand the woman's mind?
Ooh, you're getting into dicey territory there.
Yeah, really.
Yes, you mentioned go have a conversation about that outside the room. Okay.
And one other question.
Okay.
The term recessive, which is understandable when Mendelian is talking about peas, which is basically where he got the, you know, the four P's and the, what you call it, the original theory started when he discovered that phenomenon. But is there a better term that could be used rather than recessive?
No, I mean, which face is forward, right? You know, in a creator son,
it's not really recessive.
Is the father face the dominant face, or is the mother face the dominant face in a creator son? You know, remember, the terms are defined with the creator son, not with the children of Adam and Eve. That's why I went through all that rigmarole, so that you could feel comfortable about using those terms. See that they're not as weird as it might seem, you know, in labeling male dominant and female recessive when you're talking about their kids. That does feel weird, I agree. But see, you have to take it back, right? There's a dominant face with a creator son, and it's not the mother,
right?
It's the father. You know, he who has seen a creator son has not seen the mother, because the mother's face is not up front. It's not the dominant face. It's receded into the background. It's there. It's the recessive
son in this case, right?
Right, because there's mother deity, you know, his parent, his other parent is not the eternal son.
Well, in fact,
his other parent is the eternal mother son. You know, his parent.
They're not two different personalities, are they?
No, okay. But they're two different deity facts, right? He wasn't created prior to the eternal son engaging Havona and getting mother deity. He was created after mother deity had been combined with the son type deity of the eternal son, right? And that's inescapably part of that parent, right? So he gets mother nature from the mother deity of that parent, okay? Because it's a post-Havona second source and center, not a pre-Havona second source and center.
So you know, one other
parent,
question.
Okay?
That if you carry that down to us today, you know, is it logical that the firstborn, or illogical, is always father dominant, mother recessive?
No.
Or not? Okay.
No. See. Okay. So let's address that. I mean, I was going to get to that eventually, but okay. But
sorry.
The whole, you know, what we're seeing is we're trying to see just how controlled by the mother, right? Adams and Eves are procreating in the context of the mother, and the mother is very much over-controlling this, right? This is not some random sequence of boys and girls or something that are spitting out of Adams and Eves. I mean, this is incredibly organized, very precise, right? Male, you know, male, female, female, right? All this dominant recessive, I mean, it's all coordinated by the mother into this very precise pattern. And we'll see how definitive that is here as we, you know, continue with the rest of what's in here. And see, humans are not being, I mean, first of all, humans aren't as purely expressed and hence as precisely manageable as material sons and daughters. And we've talked about that many times. I mean, There's a blurring between males and females amongst the evolutionary stock, amongst us in the room here. None of us are as definitively separated into male and female as a material son and daughter are. Right? So, you know, just the fact that we overlap some, see, there's no way to have this precise pattern come out of it. But when you have it completely expressed in this very definitive dual fashion, like a material son and daughter, like they stressed, it allows for this very precise pattern to result. Okay, and so you continue on here, see, with what it says. So she bore 63 children, 32 daughters, and 31 sons before their default. Okay, so in other words, we've got basically 15 sets of four, right, to get 60. And you're going to have 30 sons and 30 daughters, but look at what's, okay, there's 32 daughters and 31 sons. You know, we've got, you know, we don't quite have the last set of four. We've got just three of the four. Before. It's like, well, wait a minute. It should be two sons and one daughter then. But we have two daughters and one son. Oh, so it isn't every time, apparently, that the male is the first single child and the female, you know, second is the single child. Sometimes, right, the recessive leads the set of four. Mm-hmm. All right, so it's a female, and then a male and a female twins, and then the male.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, at the very least, the 16th set was like that, right? I mean, but obviously, most likely, there's probably others, and so who knows what controls that, whether the male leads or the female leads. It's not surprising that the very first one was male because, you know, that is the overriding dominant fact. We're expressing the creator son here is what we're doing. Yeah.
Well, I think I understand how you read this, but I don't see it that's necessarily the only way it can be read. There were five children before the Melchizedek left, three sons and two daughters. The next two were twins. I read that as the sixth and seventh were twins. Not the third and fourth, or not the fourth and fifth.
Okay, I mean, you've got. okay, I mean, you're starting out. You know, you've got a set of four. Okay, and so you got five kids. The set of four. I mean, amongst that set of four is Adamson and Eveson. Okay, and then you've got the first child of the next set of four. That fifth child, okay, you know the next is the dominant recessive.
Oh,
yeah. You know, the next is twins.
So they're the sixth and seventh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. The twins are the sixth and seventh. See. Yeah.
I
misunderstood
what
you were saying.
Two male twins or two female twins?
No, because see, that's the whole. We're trying to understand the fact that you've got this. Mendel pattern going here. This, it doesn't pin that down exactly, but we've talked about this many times. It's highly suggestive that, you know, when you've got one dominant recessive and another dominant recessive, it's like, well, you know, how would you have one, you know, be born first? I mean, you would suspect that they have to be, you know, sort of born together. Conceived together. I mean, seeing just that. You know, remember these aren't identical twins. You are right. I mean, right. You've got this micromanagement of the whole conception process by Mother Deity, right? And seeing to it that you've got. Not just one, but two sperm and eggs, pairs coming together. Okay. It's all being micromanaged by Mother Deity here. And, I can't say for certain that they aren't born, that the set of four isn't born as four births. But it looks, you know, it looks pretty suspicious. This is actually just three, you know, really.
Well, what you mean is
three pregnancies, I should say, you know, not four pregnancies.
Gene, I think it says they followed by his sister, Ed Eason. That was the twins. It was followed by sister and Eason. They could have been twins.
Yeah.
The second son, Eason, yeah, see, describing
I,
as the second son.
I'm assuming that his sister and Eason are twins.
That's what I would think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm
the group are twins, and then... Yeah.
See, like I said, if you assume they are twins and do that little math we did with 9 months and a year, you're right, you get 7 years.
Yeah.
Right. It's all very suspicious that the dominant recessive are always twins.
Well, that would make sense because that way she could be able to procreate more children
yeah.
in a shorter period of
yeah.
time.
Yeah. Right. See, you know.
If
half of them are twins, see,
yeah.
You know,
because they didn't have it in vitro.
Two out of every four are twins.
Six at a time.
Bam. Yeah. So, okay. But anyway, I mean, so you can see that it appears that sometimes it is female and then the twins and then a male, and that. Before the default, that's where things got interrupted, is that the next child should be a male, right? Because you obviously, in that 16th set, you had female and then the twins, and so the next one, you know, the 64th, is going to be a male. Well, did that work out that way? Well, I mean, what's the first child that's that's procreated by Adam and Eve together, right, after the default? I mean, you know, Cain and Laodicea, that's Abel. Not in the pattern. It's Abel,
yeah.
A male, ta-da,
yeah.
Right? He has to be a male because that's the next, that's the fourth kid in the 16th set,
mm-hmm.
Right? He's going to be a male. And, you could even wonder if the way Abel was maturing, does that have any relationship to the fact that the set of four patterns flipped around?
Yeah.
Where the dominant is the fourth one instead of the first one? Does that make him develop slower or something? I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe it's part of, why things went awry before Abel could kind of get his feet under him.
Yeah. Drove Cain crazy.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, but see, it's all there to speculate on when you think about it precisely.
So Eve must have started aging, and she had 42 more children, but that was...
Right, at some point, right, see, post-default, she's eventually going to go through menopause. And that might be why it stops at 42. Okay, but, notice that, okay.
Do you really think they go through menopause? Adam and Eve,
Well, once they're mortal.
She's mortal.
Once they're mortal.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Became mortal.
I thought you were talking before
that. Not when they're immortal, no. I mean, it goes on, they can procreate forever.
Okay, sorry.
But once they go to mortal, I mean, right, there's going to be some point where, yeah. Who knows? I mean, they may not have been, this could take a long, long time, for them before she can't have children anymore. So they might have spread these 42 out. I mean, maybe they weren't doing it quite so breakneck. But
we might as well just back off. Screwed up pretty bad.
Okay, but let's think about the 42. Okay, so 42 after leaving the garden, besides Cain and Laodicea, besides those two. Okay, well, one of those 42 is Abel, right? The final in the set of four that they started before the default. Okay. Oh, so that's kind of interesting. So there's 10 sets of four. After Abel, and then one more. Yeah, and so you're kind of suspicious. You suppose you could just get one more dominant out, But nothing after that, right? I mean, was that last kid a boy? With, you know, Adam being the principal mind influence? That would be my suspicion. You know, that if it is an issue of she's running out of living vitality, as it were, you know, that, you know, you could get that dominant one, but the dominant recessive or the recessive, there wasn't enough energy for that. Just speculating. But does, you know, aside from those speculations, you have the definite facts, right? That you've got, you know, you've got Abel, and then you've got 10 Seths, and then one final child.
That kind of explains, so, you know, we don't have as many. I came from a large family.
Mm-hmm.
When larger families were more common, you know, there's kids take after their father or mother. They have an affinity for their mm-hmm. father or their mother.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily boys with their father.
Right.
Not necessarily girls with their mother. You right. know, girls are daddy's girls or...
Right. You know, see, you understand now. See, that they're, you know, even though we're not as precisely expressed, there's got to be some, I mean, maybe sometimes in our children, there isn't, it isn't quite so primary, secondary in the mind influence. Maybe it's a little bit more six of one, half a dozen another, you know, but probably sometimes it's very much. There's, you know, one of the parents is kind of the primary mind influence, and so of
that, how often do you hear
that? That child has
after his mother,
right. That child is just inescapably stamped with the temperament of that parent that is that primary mindal influence up until age 16. Yeah. See, so there's a lot here if you just spend some time, see, unpacking all that, getting that all sorted out, especially to figure out, you know, you can. You look at it, it's like, it feels like it's the dominant recessive, you know, thing. It's like, well, how does that work, though? Exactly what do I mean by dominant recessive? And you have to carefully think it through and finally get, like I said, I mean, to recognize that the you, right, that it, we're going to talk about its temperament being conditioned by dominant recessive influences, right? That's a mindal self, right? You know, and that, you know, thinking about how there's two parents is, you know, quote unquote, in a kind of a different way to that mindal self. There's two influences, right? There's the body influence, and then there's the mind influence, mind to mind influence, right? And that's where you have to think about the mental set of four, you know, not with the body. Right? The body is just doing the usual. You know, if Adam gives a Y chromosome, it's a boy. If he gives an X chromosome, it's a girl. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's the same way with them. But it, see, when all is said and done, again, this should help you to focus on the real you. Right? We get, humans have always struggled to recognize that the real self is not their body. We, you know, it's so difficult to let go of the thinking of yourself as a body first. I mean, think about when because of that, when someone says self-consciousness, what people interpret that term as is what is actually just merely consciousness. All right? When you think that yourself is your body, your consciousness of the existence of your body, you call self-consciousness. I mean, challenge someone with that term, right? And they'll say, no, animals have self-consciousness. We've seen that. I mean, an animal can figure out that, you know, oh, this is my paw. Yeah, that's not self-consciousness. That's body consciousness.
Consistent with this.
right? The thing that you can have, if you take delight in cultivating, that the animal can't have, is you can have a consciousness of your consciousness, not merely a consciousness of your body, right? You can recognize that you have a third element in your system. You don't just have those two elements of mind and body. You have an apart vantage point, a spiritual vantage point. You can look down on your mind that looks down on your body. Right? See, so it's all kind of there to be emphasized when all is said and done that, that the real Adam's son is not a body. The real Adam's son is a mind. All right? The real Adam's son was resurrected. His body wasn't resurrected. All right? His mind was resurrected. That's the real Adam's son. And that's the real you. All right? And the real mindful self, to focus in on even the specifics, the core of your mindful self, right, is copied to your soul. Right? That's what's resurrected.
Would you say that you could be the observer all the time?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you want to get more and more.
Because I notice I observe myself when I'm crazy or whatever. Yeah. But I am observing.
A lot of people see you just headlong through life not observing themselves. They're just experiencing.
When it's weird like that, I'm still noticing I'm observing it. Mm-hmm. And I just think, well, just let it play out and that self will come around.
Yeah, and there's a little logical point there, in that observer fact. That the best minds that have ever lived have often forgotten about. The observer is not the thing observed. Right? Right? Like we've stressed so many times, the fact that you can be aware of your feelings means that there's at least some little part of you above your feelings. That observer of those feelings. That observer is the capital I, you, right? That's what the capital I pronoun refers to, right? Is that observer.
Whereas an animal can have the feelings but can't observe.
Right. The animal has feelings, but it's not aware of its feelings. You can observe its feelings, but it can't observe its feelings.
Interesting. When I was in the Gurdjieff school, we made an effort. I mean, it was taught to self-observation as a technique that we were taught.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never something that can become automatic. It takes conscious effort.
You have to choose to observe, right? You're using your personality, your free will, to observe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the mind, being aware of the body, that all just happens automatically as a function of the mind. But to be conscious of your consciousness, you have to choose. That's an act. Right? That's not functioning. Right? Personalities act, minds function. Right? You have to act, right, to have that consciousness.
And to be effective, you have to do it without judgment. Because
that's why you can look at yourself being. Everyone has times when they act kind of crazy, I think.
Yeah.
And you don't have to take it so seriously, though, either. Mm-hmm. When you're observing it, you know that it's just a passing phase. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to wallow in it forever, and then you're not observing anything. So.
Yeah, and we all know, that if you get depressed, for instance. You lose that observer vantage point. Mm-hmm. You're just on a wash, right, in the self. You have to get above, right? And what keeps the observer above, and hence existing as an observer and not washed away?
Yeah, I was going to say,
what is that vertical draw? Spirit gravity, right? See, you have to, right? When you act by using spirit on mind, right? There is spirit in play, hence there's spirit gravity in play, right? You don't have to choose to be lifted up, I'm going to lift myself up. No, you don't lift yourself. You are lifted up by spirit gravity. You just have to choose to take a hold of spirit. The lifting happens via gravity. You know, any more than you choose to fall to the bottom of the cliff when you jump off of it, right? Right? It just happens by gravity. Right? Same way here. Right? If you choose to take a hold, right, you automatically have an observer vantage point by, because of spirit gravity. And everything is clear, right? Once you're up out of the fray. Okay, anyway. So that's the way it all lays out. So, you know, just because of the default, that disrupted their mind, as we'll see here in a minute. But it didn't disrupt them so extremely that this pattern broke. Nope, the next child should have been a son. Ta-da, it was a son, Abel. Yeah, you know, the patterns, you know, went right through the default with that set of four. So keep that in mind. See, it is just a default. It's not a rebellion. The disruption is not so extreme that they're beginning to sever their relationship to Mother Deity, to the coordinator. Yeah. Right? She's still able to have a hold of them and keep the pattern going unbroken right through the default. Okay. Right, because, you know, there's evil, but there's not sin. Right?
Would you say she was able to keep
them? The mother was able to. Yes, yes, yes. Hardy, hard, hard. Okay. All right. So, yeah, like I said, see, I knew it would take us a long time on that paragraph. What else do they tell us here?
The Adamic children did not take milk from animals when they ceased to nurse the mother's breast at 1 year of age. Eve had access to the milk of a great variety of nuts and to the juices of many fruits, and knowing full well the chemistry and energy of these foods, she suitably combined them for the nourishment of her children until the appearance of teeth.
Okay, you know, I already, you know, jumped ahead to that. See, that's where they give you that, where she's nursing for a year, you know. So like I said, you know, if you think about those five kids where, you know, the second and third are a pair, right, you know, you've got a year nursing after Adamson, a year nursing after the twins, you know, one of whom is Eve's son, you know, you're nursing after that that single daughter, a year nursing after the fifth one.
All her spare time making Eve.
Okay. See, so, you know, there's four years there of nursing, plus you've got 9 months before each of those four. You know, got three quarters. Okay, so you got 3 years. See, so it's 7 years. You know, and they're just, you know, she would, you know, and it told you that it was less than seven. So, see, it's probably she hadn't conceived the next one yet when they left, right? I mean, so it all just really seems to point to probably it's always twins, right, in the middle of the set of four. All right, and you know, they'll get into the food stuff more here in a second, but we all remember that Adam and Eve are both very, very knowledgeable scientists, okay, and as they're pointing out full well the chemistry and energy of these foods. I mean, so. You know, just imagine the kind of help that, you know, they could give to people about diet and things, you know, when they know things so, so extremely well. I mean, you know, the things that we'll never be able to figure out ourselves because it's, it's the small details that are so lost in the noise of our kind of muddled genetic expression and stuff. And I mean, it's very hard for us to it's like, well, this seems to work really well for this person. You go to the next person, well, it doesn't seem to work at all for that person. We get all confused. We can't figure out, you know, what's what. See, they understand, you know, the subtle little things about the synchronization between mind and body. Because fundamentally, you know, you're wanting a healthy body because, right, you want a sane mind, not just because you want a healthy body, right? You know, and so they know, you know, they would be gearing the diet not just for the sake of the body, but more, you know, the whole point is, the goal of the diet is the, you know, the wellness of the mind, not just the fitness of the body. And so
you wanted to make that point then, yep, that they didn't take the milk from animals, just to show they were vegetarians?
Well, we're going to get that a little bit more in the next thing. Oh, I mean, we can't, I'll just say up front here, we can't totally answer that. But we'll see here in the next one that we have to be careful not to generalize from them, because they're very different in many ways than we are. So, you know, there's apparently something about keeping their nature very well tuned as they're going through this whole pure line breeding mode. You know that we just don't understand what the deal is there, but there's some sort of physics. You know, it's not just because, you know, ooh, eating things with eyes is icky. You know it's not that. I mean, you know it isn't just some sort of arbitrary, you know, vegetarian, you know, notion like that.
It doesn't say they could not take meat from animals.
See that, right? Did not. See, that's what I mean. It's there's something, some physics going on here that they're playing very precisely that we don't understand. And just to that point, read the next one. Let's talk about it a little bit more here.
While cooking was universally employed outside of the immediate Adamic sector of Eden, there was no cooking in Adam's household. They found their foods, fruits, nuts, and cereals, ready prepared as they ripened. They ate once a day, shortly after noontime. Adam and Eve also imbibed light and energy, direct from certain space emanations in conjunction with the ministry of the Tree of Life.
Okay, we'll get to the final statement here in a minute. Let's do more about the food. So, you know, I mean, everyone probably remembers, it's not just that they're not eating meat. They're not even cooking the not meat that they're eating. Okay. Crunchy wheat kernels. and they're only eating once a day. Okay. So there's obviously some very
just them or all of them.
Well, see, and that was another thing I was about to say. And they don't really give you clear distinctions between what Adam and Eve doing and what the children is doing. It's all left kind of fuzzy. That also, the fact that it seems to be annoyingly not complete in what they're telling us is probably because they're up against some revelatory limitations. And that just reminds you again, it's probably about physics of our bodies that they're not allowed to give us hints about.
They weren't evolving at that stage either. I mean, they were going to stay the same way they were. They weren't aging.
Yeah, Adam and Eve, but of course, then their children, you know, this whole question is like, well, their children are aging and everything. Yeah. And yeah.
Common sense kind of indicates that young children would have to eat more often than that. But that's still the idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look up to your parents. You know, mm-hmm. That's the ideal. You know, so. Probably in pretty short order, they're following the pattern.
If you had light energy, you may not have to eat that much.
Yeah. So obviously you can spend some time speculating about the actual food stuff, but remember, as they're hinting in that final sentence, or speaking to in that final sentence, the master physical controllers are also feeding Adam and Eve, not the children, but Adam and Eve. Okay, the, you know, these space emanations, this isn't just some arbitrary, you know, bath, you know, that they're, you know, floating in, right, that they're drawing energy from. I mean, this is very specifically flowing through the over control of the master physical controllers into Adam and Eve. They're plugged in like this. And this quote unquote light and energy, it's very important that they have quotes there about the light, because we're not talking about photons here. Okay? So it has nothing to do with photosynthesis or anything like that. Okay? Before I talk about that a little bit more, remember that they already spoke to this back in paper 51 about the planetary atoms. Remember, we went back there for the 8 to 10 feet. You know, go back here for that too. While material blood circulates through their material bodies, they are also surcharged with divine energy and saturated with celestial light. Okay, kind of poetic there, but just, yeah, see, it's light and energy. Okay, they're repeating that. So in the one way, they're quoting this, you know, referring you back to this. You know, and there you see them, you know, saying divine energy, celestial light. They're reminding you this isn't just some sort of haphazard, arbitrary energy. You know, I mean, this is very, I mean, the master physical controllers have a divine hand. I mean, technically, they're part of what we understand as God the sevenfold. Right, they're God, okay? And, you know, so, you know, it's a divine hand that's ministering this. It's perfectly, you know, fed to them. And in conformity with the heavens, you know, celestial, as it were.
Right? It's not magic.
It's not magic. It's synchronized with the whole, and it's very, you know, so kind of both father and mother way, it's very, you know, perfectly, you know, micromanaged and, you know, and coordinated with the cosmos. Okay.
But energy for the body and light for the mind?
No, it's not. Oh. It's not. See, this, I mean, I'm not going to, it's a very complicated thing to totally unpack, but I'll just give you a little hint. Various things they say in the book, if you synthesize it together, what you begin to be very suspicious of, that this quote unquote light, you know, why are they using a term that you can see up in the forward is supposed to be about spirit luminosity? When it's obviously not spirit luminosity they're talking about here. Like I said, I'm not going to justify all this because it's too complicated right here. But what you can become suspicious of is that what they're hinting at there is that besides the various sub-electronic energies that the master physical controllers work with and can be pumping into them, doing who knows what. Remember, there's three living energies, they're called. Two of which are manipulable by the master physical controllers. I'm pretty sure, so I'm very suspicious anyway, that they're referring to one of those living energies here is the quote-unquote light. And like I said, I can't totally explain why that makes sense. But it's it fits once you unpack the details of the central universe and all kinds of stuff. And you know, once you have a lot of this sorted out, like I've worked on over the years, I think that what they're giving you a suggestion about there is that you've got one of the living energies that there's basically another spot in the book that speaks about it being used, involved here.
Did you call it living light?
No, living energy. There's dead energies. There's seven dead energies and three living energies out of those 10 forms of energy.
I thought you referred to the light as...
And the light here, quote-unquote, the quote-unquote light, I think is one of those living energies.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, they even talk about some other time, they call it light without heat, but as an energy.
Right. You have to get into...
That's maybe
you know, the statements about light without heat, you know, the different kinds of light without heat, various things. You have to synthesize all these various things in the book, and you begin to get a hint about, or you get a thought that this is hinting at one of those three, a particular one of those three living energies. Like I said, I don't want to try to get into, it's like, well, which of the two? You know, I mean, let's just leave that, leave that aside, those details for right now. But the other thing you can, you know, I mean, obviously the word light is indicating, you know, relative to the word energy. If you just think about those in kind of almost metaphorical terms, you know, the light sounds like a word that's less tangible than the word energy. Yeah, remember, those three living energies, some of the master physical controllers can't grab them at all. And the ones that can grab them can only grab two of the three. Okay, see, they're less tangible, more ethereal, you know. Just the way, you know, when we think about physical light, you know, physical light has no mass, right? So it's a lot less tangible. Okay, so I'm pretty sure that's what they're getting at. So that they're giving them, you know, this very fancy brew of sub-electronic, as it were, even sort of trans-electronic energy. Like we talked about before, that the fruit of the tree of life is somehow involved in bridging the gap, supplying the interface between it being used in their bodies and it being, you know, pumped in by the master physical controllers.
Almost a catalyst.
Because obviously, I mean, all these energies, all 10 of those are passing through me all the time, you know. But I'm probably not interfacing with them, you know, a lot, you know. And I mean, you know, especially if we've got one of these kind of ethereal sort of living energies, that's probably going to take some sort of special catalyst to work with it or engage, you know, bridge the gap to it or however, whatever word you want to use, see. Okay. All right. So anyway, all those details aside, another reason why they can have this very limited diet, if you will, from a foodstuff sense, is in many ways their primary energy input is from the master physical controllers, not from what they stick in the hole in their face. Right? They're to a degree like non-breathers. Non-breathers don't stick anything in the hole in their face. Right? The non-breathers are fed. Yeah, but you know, non-breathers are matter, material beings like us. I mean, non-breathers are fed totally by the master physical controllers. All of their energy comes from, right, this energy that's pumped in by the master physical controllers.
That's what Jesus meant when he said, "I have meat that you don't know."
Yeah, right. I mean, there's right.
Know.
Yeah. So see, they're, you know, they're getting a lot of the energy their body needs that way, and so they don't have to have as diverse a diet that they stick in the hole in their face. You got to keep that in mind. When you think I want to imitate, you know, Adam and Eve's diet, it's like, well, okay, that'd be fine if you had the tree of life and master physical controllers feeding you, but you don't. Yeah, right. See, and see, even the non-meat stuff is very circumscribed, and as I was saying, I mean, it's this highly limited diet.
No cooking.
right. So
you boil water even.
Yeah.
Tea,
you know, and see, they and what you know what they need from those fruits, nuts, and cereals may not even be what we need from them.
Yeah,
just remember, their whole metabolism is just very different and not transferable to us.
You know, there's a bunch of people running with that.
Yeah. Okay. Just, You know, don't think about it mystically. You got to think about it scientifically. Yeah. Okay. All right. What else do we have here?
The bodies of Adam and Eve gave forth a shimmer of light, but they always wore clothing in conformity with the custom of their associates. Though wearing very little during the day at eventime, eventide, they donned night wraps. The origin of the traditional halo encircling the heads of supposed pious and holy men dates back to the days of Adam and Eve. Since the light emanations of their bodies were so largely obscured by clothing, only the radiating glow from their heads was discernible. The descendants of Adamson always thus portrayed their concept of individuals believed to be extraordinary in spiritual development.
Yeah, so everyone remembers the explanation of where did the notion of halos come from? Yeah. You know, when you look at a painting, it's like, man, that's a weird concept. Where did that come from? How did humans dream up the concept of halos to indicate holiness? So there's that wonderful little tidbit about that. What was that? Oh, yeah. Right, yeah, so I was just going to get to that. So setting that, the halo stuff aside, right, you know, we've commented on this. It's like, oh, so probably at the local system headquarters, material sons and daughters aren't wearing any clothing.
Fig leaves, right?
No fig leaves, no nothing, probably.
Of course, they're beautiful.
Yes, you know, and they don't have our, you know, goofy notions. I bring it up all the time, but you know, it's appropriate to do it yet again. You know, when we think about naked material sons and daughters running around on Gerasim, and we get ourselves all wrapped around the axle, I would remind you, the normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons.
Which one of those?
In which way are you wrapped around the axle? Yes. All three? Yeah. Orthogonally, X, Y, and Z axles. Almost at the very end of paper 34. Paper about the creative mother spirit.
The clothes also keep you warm.
Yeah. Yeah, and evening time, they don night wraps, right, because it would get cool.
And also, they don't, I mean, can you imagine all of us being naked all the time? They're always beautiful, for one thing.
Clothes certainly.
Even after millions of years on a world, they look exactly like they were the first day they were there. Stunning.
John was a young hippie. He was beautiful.
That might be getting into too much information, though.
I'm glad
you're. So there's that little detail that you chuckle at is... they always wore clothing in conformity with the custom of their associates. But, you know, maybe another little parallel. Jesus did many things in the, you know, to be in conformity with his associates too, right? So you say, remember, they definitely engage in an evolutional fashion. Every true revelation is evolutional, not revolutional. It would have been revolutional for them to be running around no clothes on. Okay.
So how do you think they gave forth a shimmer of light?
Okay, yeah, so that was the other little detail I want to bring up. So you've got, again, I'm not going to try to justify all this, but when you reflect on all the details, they're using mechanical mind in its full mode. You know, there's a whole spectrum of mechanical mind engaging creatures. Right? I mean, you have you know, the very rudimentary aspects of it engaging plants. Obviously, you're going to take more of it when it engages animals, all the way up to the apex. Right? agitant mind seated upon mechanical mind, living matter body. The material sons and daughters have this full energization, that mechanical mind energy engaging. And as we'll see in a second, they have a very, very profound interplay between the mind energy and the body, more so than we have. So much so that you're literally getting a radiant energy. Remember back there in 51, it's of a violet hue, right, is where they tell you that violet hue expression. Back that same paragraph I keep going back to all the time.
Suppose they had a little ozone
right?
Wafting around.
Yeah, I mean, so you wonder just, you know, I mean, this is, see what, you know, this is a violet hue. This is a relatively high energetic phenomenon, see? And, you know, think about, you know, like when you have a spark, right, of a violet hue. You're dealing with an energetics where you're kind of in the space where what we call electromagnetic phenomena, right, lies and all that. So it's just they're that energized with mechanical mind. I mean, think about, like we were just reading about the whole precise coordination of their procreation. Think about, you know, how activated and hence micromanageable they have to be as a living system, right? So it's, everything is, you know, so, and it's literally to the point where they're so energized that it's, there's a secondary phenomenon that there's actually, they're actually radiating photons, right?
Small wonder
from this interface.
Want to fall down and worship.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I mean, bleeps are clothes pretty white and yeah. Bleaching their clothes.
I mean, you know, it's just, you know, the reason I use that spark analogy is that's kind of a simple way that you can kind of think about where this light is coming from. You've got mechanical mind energy and then, you know, the molecules of their body, right? The material energy of their body. You know, and there's this. There's this interface, there's this gap, if you will, you know, between them, right? And you're literally, you know, generating light at that interface between those two energy systems. It's such an intense, active interface. Okay. Let's see, was there anything else there? I think we got it. Yeah. The rest was about the halos. Yep.
Adam and Eve could communicate with each other and with their immediate children over a distance of about 50 miles. This thought exchange was effected by means of the delicate gas chambers located in close proximity to their brain structures. But by this mechanism, they could send and receive thought oscillations. But this power was instantly suspended upon the mind's surrender to the discord and disruption of evil.
Okay, so unlike the procreation patterns, you know, not being able to bridge the default, okay, this is disrupted. So this is a very, very fine element.
Kind of cool, though.
Okay, and let's think a little bit about the physics here again, okay? Because a lot of people get confused about what's going on here. I mean, there's no jiggling air molecules over this 50 miles. Okay, we're not talking about air oscillations. We're talking about, you know, oscillations in the mind energy. Okay, so what's the delicate gas chamber about? Again, like we were just seeing, remember there is this very intense, well-synchronized interplay between mind and body in Adam and Eve. And those delicate gas chambers, those are amplifiers. And it's a resonant chamber, a material resonance chamber, right, to amplify the oscillations in the mind energy. There's this interplay between the two. You know, and so, like, think about it in a receiver sense, right? You've got this very, very faint signal coming in to them, the mind energy, right? And you have this resonance between the oscillations in the mind energy in Adam and Eve and this resonance chamber, you know, cavity, you know, that amplifies it somehow. I mean, obviously the physics I don't understand, but I mean, the basic thing it obviously is doing is it's a cavity amplifier.
Can they talk to their kids that way?
Yes, right? See, like they said here, they're immediate children. So the first generation offspring in them. Now, the thing they don't explain is, remember, there's a downstepping from them to their children, and even the first generation are not as downstepped as the subsequent generations. Now, it could be the case that the first generation also have the delicate gas chambers. Maybe that's actually genetically passed, and it's not subsequently. Or not. Maybe only Adam and Eve have the...
Then how could they receive it?
The children wouldn't need it. You know, you could rationalize it without the children having it. I mean, you can amplify the signal sent to the children, and you can amplify the signal coming from the children, right? The children don't have to have an amplifier.
So you think these techniques are available on high?
Well, see, the interesting thing is, it's like, well, what if you get to, you know, enlightened life and you've got, you know, basically Adamic-like mortals on a world, very finely tuned high minds, do you suppose you can build little devices as amplifiers like this and, and being able to do this? See, I mean, they're giving you a little technology here. You know it's dependent upon, it has to be this very finely balanced, tuned mind, or it's not going to work. No matter how delicate the gas chamber is, and no matter where it's located, you know. but, you know, possibly. See, there's some technology here in the future for worlds enlightened life, you know, where they could do this. Everyone could be a little bit... cyborg, like this, you know, if you will.
Maybe it's a totally enhanced. Different way that it can happen too. Like maybe it's not gas chambers.
Well,
it could be something else in the future.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other thing to remember is, I mean, you know, you communicate mindily on, you know, when you get to the Imagine Worlds, you know, and you don't need any of this technology stuff like the gas chambers. I mean, you just, you know, everyone communicates mindily. Okay. And the other little thing about it, you know, saying thought oscillations, remember they tell you that the oscillations that we measure in the brain and in the heart, right, those are actually, those rhythmic pulsations are in the mind energy, and we're just measuring the shadow that's cast down on the body, you know, as an electromagnetic oscillation. But again...
Because angels, you know, even Jesus was able to tell what was going on in people's minds. So, they obviously, our thoughts are known
right.
To others other than ourselves.
I mean, yeah, just like we talked about the communication grid, you know, in the universe of universes, those are mind energy conduits, you know, and yeah. I mean, mostly they're not using a material substrate that is being oscillated, you know, like air. Right? I mean, they're using mind energy. Either you know conduits like that, or just the ubiquitous mind energy, so like I said, I mean, when you're thinking about that, those rhythmic pulsations are in the mind energy, like they tell you. I mean, see, you know, they're giving you a lot of hints about just how, if you will, AC and not DC, you know, what goes on with the mind energy is.
And 50 miles range, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean that obviously has something to do with amplification, you know, limits. Yeah, you know, can only amplify so much. You know, and it reminds you of right that there is there's a damping phenomenon here. You know, in the same way, you know, if I jiggle the air molecules, that gets dispersed, you know, with distance too. So
I squared R lost.
Yeah, there's right. There's some physics of this that we don't understand here, but anyway, just you know, the detail is just not to think that somehow, you know, you've got oscillations in the gas and that's sending air, you know, jiggling air molecules for 50 miles. That's not what's going on. Okay. All right.
The Adamic children attended their own schools until they were 16, the younger being taught by the elder. The little folks changed activities every 30 minutes, the older every hour. And it was certainly a new sight on Urantia to observe these children of Adam and Eve at play, joyous and exhilarating activity just for the sheer fun of it. The play and humor of the present-day races are largely derived from the Adamic stock. The Adamites all had a great appreciation of music, as well as a keen sense of humor.
Yeah, see, so when you don't have that upstepping of the engagement of the seventh adjutant, we're all kind of dull and drab minds. and the other little thing, you know, right at the beginning that harkens back to the preceding paragraph is a reminding of that 16 thing, right, that I bring up all the time. You know, that the biologic parents are mindily overlapping, or however you want to think about it, with the children up until about age 16, or just say age 16. So think about back with this communication with their immediate children. Do you suppose that only works until the while the child is 16 or less? Maybe. I mean, we don't know, but you can add that little speculation. Maybe you need more than just the ubiquity of, you know, adjutant mind energy. Maybe you actually have to have this closeness, this overlapping in the mind energy system for the communication to work.
Totally develop cell phones.
Yeah. okay. So, I mean, again, we don't understand the physics, so it's all just speculation, but you can't help but bring in that additional little thought. You know, that maybe that's the deal with it's only with the immediate children. It's because of the mind will overlap, you know, with their procreation. You know, and rather than, you know, well, do those children have the gas chambers, you know, and speculations like that. It just gives you another possible way to think about it. Okay.
So they mentioned about joy and play, which seems to me they were observing it. And it seems like they probably, I would guess the ordinary evolutionary races probably didn't have much of that then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so even...
They were so survival-oriented, they didn't...
Yeah, and just think about, you know, it's like, well, we can go all over the world and see little kids, you know, that are, how did they describe that? Joyous and exhilarating activity just for the sheer fun of it. Yeah, remember, there aren't any, you know, pure sangic races anywhere. Everyone's got a little bit. It may be a tiny amount, but
it goes a long way.
But it goes a long way. Yeah, just a tiny little uplift, and you have children that are, you know, have a more of a human quality to them. All right.
The average age of betrothal was 18, and these youths then entered upon a 2 years course of instruction in preparation for the assumption of marital responsibilities. At 20, they were eligible for marriage, and after marriage, they began their life work or entered upon special preparation therefor.
So again, you see these critical, you know, ages, right? The age of choice, 20, right? And they can't marry until they reach the age of choice. So all of that, you know, we don't understand the physics of all of it, but it's obviously very definitive. We see it over and over again, 16, 20, 40, et cetera. Let's see, I think that's all pretty basic. I mean, other than, you know, we're starting to see, oh yeah, there's something that we could have benefited from having modeled. No one gets married until they go through a 2 years course of instruction. Yeah. Wouldn't that improve things? Yeah. Especially if we had decent instructors. But still, you know, even if it was just 2 years of premarital disillusionment, you know, it would help, you know, rather than the giddy hormonal phenomenon that it often is, you know, amongst us. All right.
The practice of some subsequent nations of permitting the royal families, supposedly descended from the gods, to marry brother to sister dates from the traditions of the Adamic offspring, mating, as they must needs, with one another. The marriage ceremonies of the first and second generations of the garden were always performed by Adam and Eve.
So just you think, well, oh, that's unfair. What about the third generation? They don't, yeah, you got to push them out of the nest, right? see, Adam and Eve are modeling that. Yeah. You can't all stay in the womb forever here. And so it's just two generations, you know, by the third generation, they're really kind of being, you know, it's like, okay, you're kind of out on your own now. All right, so let's get a little bit more. We see we're getting teased a little bit by the life in the garden stuff there towards the end. Let's get a little bit more of this.
Section 7, Life in the Garden. The children of Adam, except for 4 years' attendance at the Western schools, lived and worked in the east of Eden. They were trained intellectually until they were 16 in accordance with the methods of the Gerasim schools. From 16 to 20, they were taught in the Urantia schools at the other end of the garden, serving there also as teachers in the lower grades.
Yeah, so again, while they're still, you know, closely connected, you know, they're trained in this kind of transcendent way, but it's, you know, once they're a separate, you know, they're separate mindedly. Then they kind of, you know, they're to a degree individuated, and they push them out into the world, you know, as it were. They send them over to the west end of the garden to the general schools there. You know, and they're about to tell you what the deal is there with the contrast. So I'll explain a little bit more in a second.
The entire purpose of the Western school system of the garden was socialization. The forenoon periods of recess were devoted to practical horticulture and agriculture, the afternoon periods to competitive play. The evenings were employed in social intercourse and the cultivation of personal friendships. Religious and sexual training were regarded as the province of the home, the duty of parents.
Okay, just a couple things I want to highlight there. The first is, you know, the italicized socialization there. Like I was just saying, see how it's all very precisely managed. I mean, you can't have genuine socialization until you first have genuine individuation. Just like when we talk on high, you know, you leave Gerasim as a definitive Marantia individual, and then you go to the constellation level, now that you're a definitive individual, to socialize those individuals. Here you see, you know, until they have separated from their biologic parents at 16, and hence fully mindedly individuated, you don't do the socialization thing. But once they're individuated, then you work on socializing those definitive individuals. And so that's the pattern. So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about how, you know, how we would set up our educational system from K through 12. Right, you know, that, you know, remembering that you've got children, you know, young children that are still connected mindedly to their parents. And thinking about how you need to take that into account in educating is an interesting detail. You know, again, it's like, well, they have a separate body, so they're individuated. No, their body is not the real child. The real child is a mind, a mindal self. And that's not separated from the parents yet. And then the other little thing is religious and sexual training were regarded as a province of the home, the duty of the parents. That should sound familiar to you. Where did we just read that?
Life on a neighboring planet.
Remember how we say, you know, I'll bet you the garden on the neighboring planet was on that island continent, and they would have been carrying on those, a lot of those traditions, because it would be very intimate with them. Yeah, see, exactly the same thing. That's what they do in that island, the island continent.
Stepping back a second.
Wait, one second here. Just go ahead, Gene.
Oh, I was thinking about the socialization, and I'm thinking of my high school years and the cliques that were prevalent.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's basically separating according to temperament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where real socialization is at a higher level, where you're
See, that's what I'm.
Has to be a super additive phenomenon.
Right. Yeah. See that whole, you know, if it's just a temperament that's predicated on the body, I mean, that's, you know, is it, like you're saying, that's not real socialization yet. That's just collecting into, you know, common, you know, material temperament pools, right? You know, and not very profound. Definitely not human, right? That's just animal temperament. Okay, now you were going to say something, John.
Well, two things. One is the socialization thing. Remember mm-hmm. they say another part about one of the credentials of being resurrected early, so to speak, is your ability to fit in socially, as mm-hmm. opposed to, mm-hmm. and otherwise you have to go to these remedial classes.
Yeah.
And that might be something along that particular line. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is, yep. is that, you know, that aspect of socialization that's different than what we think, that is really, you know, the real identification of yourself as an individual, and then. And that makes sense as to why you wouldn't get
it. In that regard, you know, I was very specific. You know, you're fully a Marantia individual when you leave the local system, and then you're socializing at that Marantia level. There's obviously individuation and socialization in a whole hierarchy, sure. right? And that's just, you know, yeah. And so, yeah, you're correct. I mean, there's a relative individuation and hence subsequent socialization all the way through the mansion worlds and stuff as well. But it's all culminating in this full personalized Marantia individualization, leaving Jerusalem. Okay, you had something else that you wanted to?
Okay.
So, you know, here we're just seeing a very, you know, this is kind of a very rudimentary thing, that the potential for socialization once children are past 16, right? It doesn't exist, that kind of socialization doesn't exist before that, because they appear to be a separate individual, but they aren't really. They're still, to a degree, a bump on their parents' biologic parents' minds. Right? They haven't fully separated, so they can't function as a separate fact totally. All right, then they give us some interesting little details here about this.
The teaching in these schools included instruction regarding: 1, health in the care of the body. 2, the golden rule, the standard of social intercourse. 3, the relation of individual rights to group rights and community obligations. 4, history and culture of the various earth races. 5, methods of advancing and improving world trade. 6, coordination of conflicting duties and emotions. 7, the cultivation of play, humor, competitive substitutes for physical fighting.
Okay, we don't, you know, obviously you could go into all kinds of the science of those details of socialization. Maybe I'll just point out, there's one that should kind of jar your tendency to go off into some mystical musing about it. Methods of advancing and improving world trade. Right, in these 16 to 20 year olds. Okay. So, notice that once you're separated at 16, you begin to, you know, there's an expectation as you start to take on some more objective thinking about the big picture, and it's not all about you and the feelings you have when you click certain spots on your handheld screen. All right. So,
what are they being trained for? To take over in the, all the various communities and stuff like that, to train the humans down the road?
I mean, they're being trained to be
leaders.
Right. I mean, you know, not only you know leaders, obviously specifically, but even more generally, humans that are well balanced and you know and have been primed to develop cosmic consciousness as they mature. You know, they're being given both this fostering of their spiritual consciousness and their material consciousness. Right? I mean, that's why I emphasized the one material consciousness thing there with the world trade. Right? I mean, you don't. I mean, even if you're not a leader, states need cosmic conscious citizens, not just cosmic conscious leaders. Right? I mean, the general citizenry needs to have some balance and hence some super additive nature. So they're trying to, set it up where you've got the basic machinery of fostering cosmic consciousness in play, and then as they biologically uplift, that machinery will have produce ever better results.
But in this case, for a while, they're still breeding amongst themselves.
Yeah, I mean, plus, remember, the non-Adamites are in these schools, too. Right,
along with you.
Yeah, yeah. And when they go to the Western schools, it's not just the Adamites; it's everyone there. Right. So, So they're teaching. I mean, obviously, Jean is right. I mean, initially here, right? It's these core people in the garden are going to be leaders. Yeah, but you know, they're setting up a pattern where it's not just for training leaders like this, but everyone like this. Like I was saying,
and these guys weren't immortal.
Yeah, I mean, the only ones that are immortal, Adam and Eve. No one, you know, Adamson is mortal. You know, long-lived mortal, but mortal. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
The schools, in fact, every activity of the garden, were always open to visitors. Unarmed observers were freely admitted to Eden for short visits. To sojourn in the garden, a Urantian had to be, quote-unquote, adopted. He received instructions in the plan and purpose of the Adamic bestowal, signified his intention to adhere to this mission, and then made declaration of loyalty to the social rule of Adam and the spiritual sovereignty of the Universal Father.
So there you see again what I was just saying about, you know, you got a core group here, obviously, that are going to be the initial leaders. Right, and so these have to be very definitive, consecrated, you know, people. But like we said at the beginning of the, you know, the group tonight, they're going to be going beyond just working on making a core group, you know, in relatively short order. The garden's not going to be the only place, you know, in a relatively, you know, short span of time. So, but initially here, yeah, it's very much leaders, and they have to. It's a select few that can, you know, can fit through all of these needle eyes that they're describing here. It's like, you know, they're being filtered through many fine sieves.
Right. Unarmed observers, kind of like leaving your guns at the sheriff's office, coming to town.
Yeah, that's a reminder of what it's like outside the wall and why there is a wall, right?
There's no arms inside Eden, but there are arms at the wall.
Yeah. Not to mention carnivores, and
they're not just talking nicely to these people that they don't want to let in.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
The laws of the garden were based on the older codes of Dalmatia and were promulgated under seven heads. 1, the laws of health and sanitation. 2, the social regulations of the garden. 3, the code of trade and commerce. 4, the laws of fair play and competition. 5, the laws of home life. 6, the civil codes of the golden rule. 7, the seven commands of supreme moral rule.
Okay, I mean, that's, you know, back to Dalmatia, as they're going to say here in a second. Obviously, that last one with the seven, you know, the quote-unquote seven commandments. And I don't think we need to say too much about that other than just, you know, it should strike you that, you know, for way back then, that's a lot of complexity. Okay? So, again, we see how, for this core group, they're being put through a very rigorous regimen. They're trying to get them very grounded and focused and precise, so they can work well together and be very effective when they go out as to influence others. This is a very, very complex, strict regimen that they're being adopted into here. You know, and that too, you might feel some tension with your unity consciousness about them saying that there were that many lines drawn and you were supposed to stay between those lines. But again, there can't be any cosmic consciousness if there isn't that individuality conscious, if it isn't trained, right, to be precise and not just, you know, going wherever.
You know, that would sober up the notion, the romantic notions about going back to the garden.
Yeah, right. Yeah, how many of those people want to go back? They're wanting to go back to a garden with no laws, quote unquote. Yeah. Well, there is no such garden on any world, right? The real garden has lots of laws. Well, I want it to be like Havona. No, there's absolutely precise laws in Havona, and you can't vary one iota from them. You know, liberty in law. See, wanting that place with no laws, that's, you've just gotten sucked into the Lucifer Rebellion, right? That's liberty without law, not liberty in law. Right? See, that's the thing about that. It's a sneaky thing about that going back to the garden. You know, the garden that you're imagining is not built by God. That garden you're imagining was built by Lucifer. That one without laws. And everything is just, you know, whatever you want to do.
Well, eventually, as it says, you know, people become self-governing.
Yeah.
So the laws were there, but you know what I'm saying? It's not like they're there to protect you against all the lawbreakers, so to speak. So it becomes, as you say, it almost becomes the way of life.
Yep.
It's different.
All right.
The moral law of Eden was little different from the seven commandments of Dalmatia. But the Adamites taught many additional reasons for these commands. For instance, regarding the injunction against murder, the indwelling of the thought adjuster was presented as an additional reason for not destroying human life. They taught that whoso sheds man's blood by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man.
Okay, so yeah, quote unquote on that end. I mean, so a couple things there. I mean, obviously they have to tweak, you know, the bit of the commandments that are specific about the prince's corporeal staff and stuff like that. But, you know, it's obviously it just gets, you know, tweaked relative to Adam and Eve's dispensation. And things like, you know, thou shalt not murder stay the same. But they are telling them about thought adjusters now. So, you know, we're going, wow, we finally know about thought adjusters of the fifth epical revelation. Well, okay, we should have known about those for a very long time. And the fun little thing there with the quote-unquote, you know, that quote from Genesis is, you know, between the lines they're saying, oh, so what in the story in Genesis, that is part of God's covenant with Noah post-flood. So they're pointing out that little element in the Noah story, see, has been pulled forward all the way from Adam and Eve's time, you know, and used in that story. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, verbatim out of the King James Version there. They love to throw in little elements like we saw with the things that are in the Genesis story about the garden that actually tie back to the real garden or the actual garden, maybe I should say. You know, here's another thing. See, there's other threads in our mythology that do harken back to Adam and Eve. They get used in various different ways in various stories, but you know, they're just telling you, well, actually, that started with Adam and Eve. Okay.
The public worship hour of Eden was noon. Sunset was the hour of family worship. Adam did his best to discourage the use of set prayers, teaching that effective prayer must be wholly individual, that it must be the desire of the soul. But the Edenites continued to use the prayers and forms handed down from the times of Dalmatia. Adam also endeavored to substitute the offerings of the fruit of the land for the blood sacrifices in the religious ceremonies, but had made little progress before the disruption of the garden.
So in other words, you know, Jesus is like the college teacher that can't teach college level, has to teach him reading and writing and arithmetic first. Right? I mean, it's like, that's exactly what Jesus was trying to do, see? Yeah. Right? I mean, so... That's definitely one of the things between the lines there is how Adam and Eve, you know, would if they hadn't defaulted, they would have seen to a lot of those basic things. So Michael could have come and worked on a much higher foundation. Instead, he's working down on square one and being just as unsuccessful as Adam and Eve were in the short time that Adam and Eve were doing it. Jesus was doing it for even shorter time. But you think...
Yeah, they've been successful. He may not even...
Yeah, but you do wonder here, you know, in the quote, desire of the soul thing, it's like, oh, so is the Bible using that expression, you know, has some hearkening back? Because after they're talking about thought adjusters, they were probably giving him some sense of where your thought adjuster is that is, quote-unquote, in your soul. You know, like when he's talking about the upper domain and the hourglasses. Kind of effectively the soul. It's not the literal object, Marantia object, but it's the part that gets copied to make the Marantia object, so it's effectively the soul, and that's where your adjuster is. Yeah. So, see, they were probably giving him some basic concept like that, and there's some of those things made an impression and carry forward into the way the Hebrews talked about stuff in biblical times, or, you know, the Egyptians, even some of that old stuff, you know, that's in the Old Testament, even before the Hebrews. All right.
Adam endeavored to teach the races sex equality. The way Eve worked by the side of her husband made a profound impression upon all dwellers in the garden. Adam definitely taught them that the woman, equally with the man, contributes those life factors which unite to form a new being. Theretofore, mankind had presumed that all procreation resided in the loins of the father. They had looked upon the mother as being merely a provision for nurturing the unborn and nursing the newborn.
Yeah, see, and there's a simple the yes. difference between appearance and reality. Right? See, initially everyone's like, well, it appears that the man is the only one contributing anything here, right? You know, out of sight, out of reality, you know. Right. But
it's so funny because that's appear that way. The woman bears the child.
So. Yes, but yeah, I mean, no one is seeing the eggs, right? So,
true.
Hey, right, yeah,
even in the animal world, I guess, which they wouldn't be able to observe.
Right, they weren't. You know, they weren't totally putting the two and two together. Totally, it's like, well, you know, the chicken has this great big egg, you know, apparently humans must have little, you know, I mean, they just weren't putting two and two together. And so, of course, in the Bible, you've got the whole loins of the father thing. So there, see, I brought that up because it's just a simple example of trying to get you to think that what a revelation is always doing is it's trying to help people to understand what the reality is behind the appearances, right? That's what a revelation is always doing. That's what this book is trying to do you. It's not describing appearances. You can observe those and measure them yourself. It's trying to help you to understand what the reality is that you can't see behind the appearances that you can see and measure with scientific instruments and all that. Scientific instruments don't measure reality. They measure appearances.
Truth, two? Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah, not to mention, right. I mean, to get to the reality is also to get to the truth that flows through the facts of reality. Yeah. You know, all of that is only what the scientist can do, you know, what the human can do. It doesn't have to just be science. It can be the religionist as well, you know, whoever. Right? You need the philosophy to get to the reality. The science and the religion are just giving, are just considering the appearances, systematizing the appearances.
They have a reality to them.
Right, there's genuine appearances have reality behind them. Yeah, I mean, appearance is not imagination. Appearance is objective, not subjective. Like I said, scientific instruments—they're not in your mind—measure appearances. A thermometer measures an appearance; it doesn't measure a reality. A ruler measures an appearance; it doesn't measure a reality. Reality is something that only your insight and reflective thinking can get to. You can't observe it. You can't measure it. And it's like, well, that's not the way humans use the word reality. Well, that's the way the revelators are using the word reality. And that's the real meaning of the word reality. Yeah. Okay.
Adam taught his contemporaries all they could comprehend. But that was not very much, comparatively speaking. Nevertheless, the more intelligent of the races of Earth looked forward eagerly to the times when they would be permitted to intermarry with the superior children of the violet race. And what a different world Urantia would have become if this great plan of uplifting the races had been carried out. Even as it was, tremendous gains resulted from the small amount of the blood of this imported race, which the evolutionary peoples incidentally secured.
It's all pretty straightforward, but you have to chuckle. It's like, well, you know, there's all this teaching, all these details, yada, yada, yada. When do we get to intermarry? Yeah. Ooh, very intriguing. You notice that's between the lines there. Okay.
And thus did Adam work for the welfare and uplift of the world of his sojourn. But it was a difficult task to lead these mixed and mongrel peoples in the better way.
Okay, so just one little final thought. You notice they set that apart in a paragraph by itself because it's got a, you know, a dicey statement in there. They use the word mongrel. You know, you're probably aware of how that is often thought of as a very negative, politically incorrect word. You know, if you use it for something besides a dog, you know, these days, you know, even for a dog.
Yeah.
I mean, what's, you know, why do they have, you know, it's like, well, doesn't mongrel just mean mixed? Why do they have mixed and mongrel? Okay, well, there's mixed, like especially the mixed, you know, that Adam and Eve, you know, Adam and Eve are going to oversee the mixing. Right. The fundamental thing about mongrel is the mixing is indiscriminate.
Yeah.
It's lacking in the use of human insight, right, as a predicate for the mixing.
There's no plan behind
right.
it.
Right. There's definitely no objective plan behind it. Yeah. So, and notice that's the second of the two, right? The foundational thing that's happening is indiscriminate mixing. And that's one of the reasons why Adam and Eve were so despairing. It's like, ah, hundreds of thousands of years of this complete, you know, or, well, 150,000 years or, you know, or anyway, of this indiscriminate mixing. You know, what do we do with this mess? You know, the prince's staff should have seen that it didn't get so muddled up like this. Oh, my goodness, Phil. Well, that's why they're just, you know, it's such a daunting task.
They knew well, the word much. Mongrel helps you realize that, what they had to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is...
And ultimately why they didn't make it very long. Okay. All right, but, you know, it's just, you know, the fact that you can even look up the word mongrel and you'll see them using the word indiscriminate, and you go, oh, that discrimination thing, that's bad, you should never discriminate. Remember how we've got that totally... turned around. No, you must discriminate. That's what it means to be a human. And discriminate is not a negative word, it's a positive word.
Does it mean judge?
It means objectively, judge, if you would, if you will. You need to penetrate deeply, right? Okay, so the paper will finish up like I hinted at, when we were doing the day one, day two, up to day six thing before. They actually, talk about that legend of creation a little bit and give you more about the relationship between what's in the Bible and what really happened, talk about that. So there's a little aside here as they finish off this paper. So we'll do that, and then, if you look, flip, you see it, it's over already. The next paper is The Default of Adam and Eve. So it's a short story. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.